The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Last week I suggested that I want to be including a little more in the way of discussion, and so feel free to ask, to raise your hand to ask questions during the talk. If you have questions during the talk, I'm happy to take questions. And after the talk, also, there's no particular need for the questions, if you have questions, for them to be particularly related to the talk. If you have questions about your practice, I want to provide an opportunity where there's for exchange here. And I also said last week, I know that some of you are uncomfortable talking into the microphone. And so if you have a question that you would like to ask but don't feel comfortable asking it into the microphone, then you're welcome to write a question on a piece of paper before the class and bring it up and leave it in my bowl. And nobody did that this time, so we will just have questions into the mic this week. But I want to keep that out there. If people would like to ask questions anonymously, that opportunity is available. So tonight I'd like to talk about letting go. There's so many different ways in our day-to-day lives that we experience stress, suffering, dissatisfaction. There are ways from the very mild to the very profound that we experience suffering. We might experience a sense of mild loneliness from time to time, or we might feel bored every now and then. We might feel small reactions to physical pain or a sense of hurt if a friend says something a little bit painful to us. We might feel not seen or not understood. And then there's some stronger kinds of suffering that we experience when we get very ill and there's extreme pain in the body, or if a loved one dies. This kind of suffering is a little bit harder to bear. And then there's the pain, the suffering that is in our society, and that some people are undergoing extreme pain through war, through racism, through lots of different kinds of discrimination. The promise of the Buddha is that it's possible to be free of suffering, free of stress, free of dissatisfaction. How is this possible? The understanding about how suffering is put together in the Buddhist psychology is that suffering results from a series of causes and conditions. So that our experience itself, our experience from moment to moment, is a result of things that have happened in our past, plus how we're relating to it here in the present moment. So all of these things come together, these causes and conditions come together to create our experience in the present moment. And these causes and conditions sometimes come together to create suffering. So since suffering results from causes and conditions, This is a very important point. Suffering is not random in our lives. It actually has causes. There's a chain of cause and effect relationship that leads to suffering in our lives. And since that is so, there's the possibility, if we can dismantle the causes and conditions in some way, that suffering would not arise. I want to take a few moments to talk about what I mean by causes and conditions. When I use the term causes and conditions, when I talk about conditions, I'm referring to a very broad set of things in our experience. It refers to our history, the way we've been brought up, the things we've experienced in our past. So that's kind of the conditioning of our lives. How our parents raised us, what our parents believed, what we learned in school. All of those things constitute conditions that have come in, that have brought us from where we were into this moment. So all of those conditions have come together into this moment. I also mean what's happening in the world. I mean, conditions can constitute things that are happening here and now in the world. The way the weather is, the lighting in the room, the temperature, all of those things are conditions for what's happening for us. And then there are situations. There's kind of the way that we interact with other people, that somebody else comes in and is doing something based on their history, their causes and conditions, and we meet that. So just in a very simple way, if, you know, you go have lunch with a friend at their house, there are conditions about what they've decided to prepare for the meal. Just very simply, that there are ways that decisions other people make have an impact on us. That's just a very simple example. There are very powerful examples of that, decisions other people make that have an impact on us. So that's what I mean by conditions. By causes, I refer more to immediate or direct causes, things that are much more right in the moment. So with respect to suffering, there are many conditions that come together to create our suffering. And the teaching is that craving or wanting is the direct cause of suffering in the moment. So basically, the craving is what puts the complex of suffering together. It's like it's the craving is kind of what takes all the various conditions and puts it into the direction of suffering. It's heading us towards the direction of suffering. And then there's another quality of mind, clinging, that is what holds that suffering into place. It's kind of like the linchpin that holds suffering in place. Our clinging to the way we think things should be, the way we'd like them to be. That clinging is kind of the piece that if you can pull out the clinging, let go of the clinging, let go of the craving, the suffering will fall apart no matter what the conditions are, no matter what the other conditions are. So this is really the second noble truth of the Buddhist teaching, that suffering is caused by craving, by wanting, essentially by wanting things to be other than they are. We either want things that we don't have, we want to get rid of things that we have that we don't like. So this wanting is the thing that heads us in the direction of suffering. It's the cause of suffering. And then there's the next thing that follows on from that wanting, that craving, is clinging. The stronger the clinging is to something, the more we want to hold on to something to keep it some way, the more we want things to be the way we have them and want to hold on to that, the more the suffering will be when the situation falls apart. So the stronger the clinging, the stronger the suffering, stronger the potential for suffering. So tonight I'd really like to focus on this topic of clinging and letting go. And those two pieces, they're kind of, you think the notion of clinging is holding on to something, and letting go is its release. So to let go of clinging, it's helpful to have an understanding of what we cling to. What is clinging and what do we cling to? The Buddha talked about four different areas that we typically cling to. And these four areas are sense pleasure, views, then something that's called rites and rituals, and identity view, or the view of self. Those four things: sense pleasure, views, rites and rituals, and self. And I'll talk just a little about each one of these and how we can work with letting go, how we can bring our mindfulness to support an understanding of the clinging and a way that helps us to move towards letting go. So sense pleasure. This is kind of the basic kind of clinging. One teacher says that this kind of clinging basically underlies all the other kind of clingings that we tend to do, that we tend to want to have things to be the way we like them. We like to have our sense environment pleasing. We like things that look pleasant around us, things that feel pleasant to our body. We like to hear things that are pleasant. We want to get rid of things that are unpleasant. So when the motorcycle goes by, there's a kind of a resistance, an aversion to that. It's kind of like we're holding on until it goes away. So we cling to having things be the way we like them, this sense pleasure. And the sense pleasure is really about the five physical senses, creating an environment where the five physical senses are pleased. Now, it's not the sense pleasure itself that's a problem. It's the attachment to it that will cause a problem for us. And again, if you think about this in your own experience, if you've had something, some wonderful experience or wonderful thing in your sense environment, and there's been a strong attachment to that, there's more suffering when that thing ultimately disappears, as it will, because all things are impermanent. So there's the suffering that is, again, as I said before, directly related to the intensity of the attachment to it. If we're not attached to the sense pleasure, it's not a problem. So learning to let go of the attachment, it's the attachment to the sense pleasure that is really the cause of the problem. Having sense pleasure come in and out of our lives is not a problem. The effort that it takes to create a world where we are surrounded by sense pleasure, that effort itself is a bit stressful. So if you are craving sense pleasure and trying to construct your life to have a lot of sense pleasure, you're making a lot of effort in that direction. There is some stress and some dissatisfyingness around that at times. So that effort itself is stressful. Then if we lose the thing that we tried to gain, that is suffering. That is stressful. So essentially what we need to do around sense pleasure is let go of our usual relationship to it. Not having it be such a focus to our orientation to our world. not a problem for sense pleasure to be there, but to require it as a source of happiness, that is where we end up ultimately suffering more. We may, through the process of creating a few moments of sense pleasure or a few days of sense pleasure, if you can manage to sustain it on a trip to Hawaii, you know, you might end up with several days of sense pleasure. If you can manage to sustain it for a while, but it will ultimately end. And if there's been a strong attachment to it, if there's been a strong attachment to the way life was when you were on vacation in Hawaii, there's going to be some suffering when you come home and have to go back to work. That's probably a mild kind of suffering for most of us. But the letting go piece is not so much about letting go of, it's not about pushing sense pleasure away. It's not about doing that. But it's about the letting go of the need to construct our lives to continually be surrounded by sense pleasure. So this investigation in sense pleasure, some of it has to do with looking at what do we actually appreciate about the sense pleasure. So we're not asked actually to jump over the sense pleasure and say, you know, that's not good. There is a happiness to sense pleasure. There is a happiness there. But it is fleeting. It is not lasting. And ultimately, it's not that satisfying because it dissipates. And then we just end up on this round of having to try to create the next moments of sense pleasure. So the letting go piece is really about seeing if there's another way to orient our lives, rather than oriented around sense pleasure. The second type of clinging is clinging to views. Now this one is, this one teacher that I was reading the article about today said that the sense pleasure is kind of what underlies all the different things that we do, but I actually think views is really more central in a way. Views are clinging to ideas about how things should be. Views about the world. I should be a happy person. People should behave nicely to each other. There's all kinds of different views that we hold about the world. Personal views, which are, we all have our own personal views, but probably more deeply rooted are the kind of cultural views that we hold. What we value as a culture. And one of the things that this culture values in particular is having money to get what I want. So there's all kinds of views that we hold that come through our conditioning that it's hard to actually see these views. It's kind of like we've grown up with them, so they're not so clear to us. These views, I mean, if there's people have all kinds of differing views. I mean, the differing views are a major source of contribution to quarrels, dissent, war. In fact, the Buddha claims that views are the source of all quarrels and dissent. There's a quote I have about this. from the Buddha. A person who associates himself with certain views, considering them as best and making them supreme in the world, because of that, all other views are inferior. Therefore, he's not free from contention with others. So essentially, by holding a view, if we hold a certain view, we can make others wrong because we're holding this view. So the view of America as the evil empire by Al-Qaeda or whatever, that view that's held, that strong view that this empire should be destroyed at all costs, the degree of fixation on the view, again, relates to how much suffering happens around the view. How tightly we hold to the view. So the strength of clinging to the view that Americans are infidels creates the actions to try to kill Americans. So our views also create a kind of a filter for us. When we have a certain belief, when we have a certain set of beliefs, the way we see our world, it's like we only take in things that correspond with that belief, or it's harder for us to see things and take things in that don't correspond with that belief. So the view that we hold in our minds actually changes how we perceive our world. So we see things that confirm that particular belief, and we don't see things, or we dismiss things perhaps that don't confirm that view. So one simple example from my own life, this was really before I was a practitioner, but I really held this strong view of myself as a miserable person. I really believed that was who I was. I had this very strong view around that. And then, if I was happy, I was happy, but there was something about it that was, I would dismiss. It'd be like, well, yeah, I'm happy now, but I really know that I'm a miserable person. So it's kind of like I wasn't really letting in the happiness. It's like the view of miserable was so strong that it kind of blocked the genuine connection with the happiness. This kind of thing happens to us a lot, where we have a view, where we have a tendency in our mind, we're holding a particular tendency, and we filter our input based on that tendency. So some of these views, as I said, are really hard to see. It's very hard to let go of something that you don't see. It's hard to know to let go of something that's kind of hidden in our experience. So the first thing we need to do is to recognize that we have views. That most of the way we approach our lives is through some view or other. So to begin to recognize those views. One potential way to explore this that I'm interested in looking at is to look at value judgments. If there are value judgments, there's probably some kind of a view going on. If there are value judgments about right, wrong, better, worse, beautiful, unbeautiful. What, beginning to recognize when a value judgment is held as a way to explore Maybe there's a view underlying that value judgment. So understanding that we have views is a huge part of beginning to be able to let go of them. That's the first step, is being able to see them. Then as you begin to notice the views, notice that when we start to recognize there's certain behaviors too that the Buddha points to, in quarreling, dissent, arguing. If there's quarreling and dissent and arguing going on, there are views happening on both sides probably. So if that behavior is happening, that's another pointer to look back. Well, what's the view? What's the view that's happening here? And then you could also play with a little bit. This can be a little bit touchy for some people. Letting go of behavior that you see is motivated by views. See if you can let go of the outer behavior in favor of looking at the interior landscape. What is the view? What's my relationship to that? How strongly do I hold that view? So really starting to look at what is a skillful relationship to views. So for example, I hold a view that non-harming is valuable. I mean, I hold that as a view. And that may be a skillful use of views, unless I'm using it in a way to beat somebody else up for not being, for being harmful. So if I can use that view as a support towards behaving skillfully and compassionately, and not out of greed, aversion, or delusion, that may be beneficial for a time. Now, this is another piece, actually, which is kind of a paradoxical piece around clinging in the teachings. And that is that in the path of the practice, the path that while non-clinging is an ideal, it's essentially is that we talk about clinging and letting go of clinging, but we cannot begin with non-clinging. We cannot say, okay, I'm not going to cling to anything. Because the pattern or the power of clinging is so strong that we will cling to something. And so the teaching actually, or the path, suggests finding things that are more skillful to cling to as a way to navigate our practice. So this example I give about holding the view of non-harming is a skillful view to hold. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment, in a few moments. Talk a little more about how that happens or works in our practice. Then there's the third kind of clinging to rules and observances or rites and rituals. And this is, I have a hard time coming up with clear examples in our culture so much. It's the belief that certain behaviors will lead to purification, freedom, and happiness. And in India at the time of the Buddha, there were clearly a lot of these going around, that they believed if you burned certain herbs at a certain time of day, or you bathed in the river Ganges, or you behaved like a dog, that you were purifying yourself, and that it was the behavior that was important, not what was going on in the mind. And that's the key piece that is important to understand about this clinging to rules and observances. This is about blindly following behavior without reflecting on the purpose or meaning behind it. And so in our practice, it's possible that we might be clinging to the practice of the precepts, the practice of not killing, not stealing, not engaging in sexual misconduct, etc. We might engage in that just simply by just saying, well, that's what I'm supposed to do, you know, and not really reflecting on how it cultivates the letting go of greed and aversion in the mind, not understanding how the tendencies towards greed and aversion manifest in those behaviors, and that the point of refraining from those behaviors is not just to simply refrain from the behaviors, but to understand the motivating forces inside and to witness them, to watch them, to observe them, to understand them. And so if you really are just going about following through on these precepts by just a rote behavioral thing, you're not training your mind. You're not really benefiting your mind. And that is what is meant by clinging to rules and observances, that blind following. So again, the letting go has to do with the noticing. Yeah, Mary Ellen.
I was raised Catholic, and I don't think I thought about the rituals that were involved, but going to Mass on Sunday meant you had a better chance to get into heaven. So there are tons of rituals.
So in Catholicism, I feel like there were tons of rituals we were asked to follow without really being encouraged to think independently.
And that is exactly what he's referring to.
Right. And yeah. So I think in our own culture, that's most religions ask you to take it on faith and not explore for yourself.
That's probably true. I was not exposed to Catholicism, so.
Lucky.
Is that called blind faith?
That's exactly it. It's the blind faith that is not, that the Buddha wants to encourage us to not have, that yes, faith, but observing, understanding, coming back to reflect on what we are doing. So it's the whole thing about this practice is really that it is an exploration. And it's not just believing. But thank you for that. I will remember the Catholicism for the future.
Or any religion, so you don't get in trouble with a room full of Catholics. But any religion where you're expected to take it on faith.
On faith, right.
And not explore.
Then the last aspect that we tend to cling to is the identity view, the notion of self. And this one actually underlies all of the others. And if we didn't cling to this idea of self, there wouldn't be a sense of someone who needs to be enlightened or someone who needs to have sense pleasure or someone who is miserable. So there's four ways of identification that are described, and I'm just going to go over this briefly. There's this idea of myself is the same as something. So, for instance, I am the one who feels, or I am the one who chooses. Then there's something is mine. It's kind of possession. So the body is mine, or these sense pleasures are mine, these objects are mine. That's a way of identification. Then there's something is inside of me. I don't have any thought of that one. Something's inside of me. My body is in me. I could envision somebody having that belief. Or I am in my body. That's the other version of it. That's the two directions. Something's inside of me or I am inside of something. I'm inside of consciousness. That could be a way that somebody thought of themselves, that, you know, it's kind of like I am the, or I am this consciousness. I am this expanded consciousness. That is who I am. All of these are related to this some notion of self, some notion of identity, some notion of being something. We can't usually simply let go of this either. Most of these things, actually, we can't usually simply let go of. We really have to find a pathway out of it. These patterns are deeply entrenched. So one thing to begin to do around identity is start to look at what we take to be self. What is it that you think is you? Yeah.
Are you being critical of seeking the sense of pleasure?
The seeking, yes.
The seeking part.
The seeking part, yes. I mean, if you're seeking a sense of pleasure, then essentially that's becoming a motivating thing for your life. Now, if pleasure is in your life, that's not a problem. But the needing it to be is what ultimately, that causes us, that does cause us suffering.
Don't you think it's a goal? That could be attained?
Not continually, no.
You mean you really shouldn't wake up every morning thinking there's bluebirds outside and I think I'll seek some pleasure, no matter if it's looking at the flower or whatever it might be.
Well, I mean, it's fine to take in the pleasure that's there, but to have to say, okay, what's the next pleasure I'm going to have?
Like to be that goal-oriented.
Yes, to be very goal-oriented around it. You will suffer around it because you're trying to construct your life to be a certain way.
And better than misery, right?
Well, it's true. And I'll get to this in a moment, actually, because, you know, again, the way out of clinging is really to find more skillful things to cling to. In a way. There is a sense, there is a kind of a happiness that comes with sense pleasure. And the Buddha doesn't deny that happiness. It is a kind of happiness. He just says it's an inferior kind of happiness. It's very transient. It's not ultimately very satisfying.
Well, better than misery though, right?
Oh yes, it's better than misery.
You have a choice between pleasure and misery. Most people would seek pleasure.
Absolutely. And that's actually why I think we get so hung up. As she said, most people, if we have a choice between pleasure and misery, most people would seek the pleasure. That's partly why we get so hung up on this, that we only see, actually, as we seek pleasure in our lives, and we get the pleasure, we get this moment of satisfaction that, oh, okay, I figured it out. I've gotten this pleasure. I know how this works, and my life is good for this moment. And then something else comes along, and it's like, okay, I've got to do it again. I've got to find, a little bit of misery comes, I've got to find a way back to that pleasure. And we see over and over again that there's this kind of little bit of miserableness that comes up, and it's like, well, what can I want and get that'll make me feel better? And then we do that, and we, over time, over our lifetime, we feel like the best happiness that we can possibly have is getting what we want when we want it. That that's the best it gets. Now, it's definitely better than miserable, but it's not the best that it gets. So there are, essentially the kind of sense pleasure happiness is dependent on arranging the world. Just continually having to arrange the world. It'll fall apart, and then you arrange again. It falls apart, and you arrange again. It falls apart, and you arrange again. And I know that I've come up with this, well, is this all there is? You know, is this what life is about? Arranging. So that kind of happiness of sense pleasure is a happiness that's dependent on conditions of the world. There are pleasures that can be found that are not dependent on the conditions of the world, but are more related to our own relationship with our minds. So the meditative training begins to introduce us to the pleasure of concentration, of a mind that's settled and still and calm. And it begins to introduce us to the pleasure of insight and the pleasure of non-reactivity, the pleasure of not being reactive when things aren't the way I want them to be, is a much greater kind of happiness than having things the way I want them to be. And it's ultimately more reliable, Although still it's dependent on conditions as well. So the, you know, in terms of the path, that moving from clinging to sense pleasures or having our orientation be around sense pleasure, the suggestion or the path would be to move to seeing where there are forms of happiness that are more reliable, kind of more internal, where we cultivate the mind's ability to be settled and still and recognize the pleasure of that. We cultivate the mind's ability to be non-reactive, and we really recognize the peace of that. And so that is a clinging as well. That clinging to the pleasure of concentration is a clinging. A clinging to the pleasure of insight is a clinging. But it is a step that moves us in the direction of non-clinging. So there's a kind of a pathway of clinging. It's kind of like we cling, we normally have this kind of clinging of just, clinging to whatever seems the most immediately satisfying, the most immediate gratification. And we look around us and say, where can we get the most happiness right now? As opposed to what will ultimately be most satisfying. And the Buddha teaches that what is most satisfying is to completely let go of all clinging. Let go of everything. All clinging. And he says that is the greatest happiness. It is a happiness that is non-constructed. It's not dependent on any conditions whatsoever. So there's this kind of paradox. There is this kind of paradox around clinging, that the path itself is not one of complete non-clinging. In a way, it can't be. That we need to cultivate skillful clinging in order to let go of less skillful clinging. So sense pleasure is easier to let go of when we see that there are more, when we begin to get a taste of other pleasures that are actually more deeply satisfying. With views too, with clinging to views, the first aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path is right view. And so we have to, in a way, cling to view as well. But the view that we need to cling to is one that helps us to move towards non-clinging altogether. And that sounds a little paradoxical. A view that supports not clinging to any views at all. So we need to be able to hold a view that allows us to ultimately let go of views. And the view that the Buddha taught is the view of understanding suffering, understanding the cause of suffering, understanding that cessation of suffering is possible, and understanding the path leading to the cessation of suffering. That's kind of the main view he taught. There's one sutta that somebody was talking, one of the monks was talking to some followers of another sect about various views, and they said to him, well, what views do you hold? And he said, well, tell me first what views you hold, and then I'll tell you what kind of views I hold. And so they tell him all of these different views, like, I hold that the self is eternal, anything else is wrong, or I hold that the self is not eternal, and everything else is wrong, or I hold that the world is there's nothing after death. So all these different views that they hold. And then he says, well, I hold the view that clinging to any view is stressful. And that kind of view ultimately allows you to notice, you see, even at some point the holding of that view begins to be seen as stressful. So really the stress, the suffering is kind of how we navigate when the clinging is getting to be unskillful. So we move from less skillful clinging to more skillful clinging, and we navigate that by realizing, okay, yeah, when I'm trying to figure out how to be happy based on trying to construct my world, and I see it fall apart, and I try again, and it falls apart, and I try again, and it falls apart. At some point, that gets so frustrating, it's like, okay, there's suffering there. So then we really begin to see the suffering of that clinging. And then perhaps moving towards something else. Seeing that doesn't work. Maybe there's something else out there. We begin to engage in the meditation practice. We start to recognize and see the power of the mindfulness and the power of the beautiful states of mind that arise in meditation. And then we start to feel, what am I doing wrong? I can't get that state back. There's clinging there. The suffering has appeared because of the clinging. Then you need to let go. When the suffering appears, there's clinging. And that's the indicator at that point that, okay, time to let go of that. Now, it might not necessarily be that you need to let go of the cultivation of concentration, but you do need to let go of clinging to the results of concentration. There's a simile that the Buddha teaches that I'm sure many of you are familiar with. It's the simile of the raft. And he teaches this, that in order to cross over a raging stream, you might come to a raging stream and there's no ferry, there's no bridge, there's nothing there. And how do you get to the other side? And the raging stream kind of refers to the raging stream of our suffering. How do we cross over this flood of suffering? And he says, well, you could build a raft. You build the raft out of what's around you. You get the stick, the mud, the stick, the leaves, the logs, and kind of put it all together. And through this building of this raft, you manage to cross over this stream. And the mud, the sticks, all of that stuff refers to the Dharma and to our experience. Both pieces together. That we use what's around us, our present moment experience, combined with mindfulness, concentration, and effort to cross over suffering. And then he says, and then somebody getting to the other side of that stream on that raft, if they get on that other side of that stream and they say, well, this raft has been very useful to me, why don't I pick it up and carry it around with me? Is that useful? No. And so he said, remember that I have said the Dhamma is similar to a raft. It's for the purposes of crossing over, not for the purpose of clinging. So even the teachings of the Buddha themselves, he said, not to cling to. But when you're crossing over that river, you can't let go in the middle of the river. You have to, in a way, cling to the teachings, cling to the views, to support your moving across the suffering. When you're completely free of suffering, then you can let go. And in fact, the complete freedom of suffering is the letting go. You don't actually have to let it go at that point, I think. It's my kind of understanding of it anyway. So we have a few more minutes if there's any other. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Can there be a big danger in skillful clinging? You know, you could become so attached to this book or this teaching or this practice, and it could actually cause like a lot of suffering and be very difficult to let go of in the long run.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that, again, the guideline that the Buddha suggests looking at is suffering. So if it's causing suffering for yourself or others, there's something that needs to be released. Something that is being held to. And it's probably some kind of a view, and it's probably some sense of self in there. I am this great practitioner. Yeah. And it can cause a lot of suffering. You know, it's like, I had this one experience on a retreat where I, I really kind of got this realization that I had a kind of a negative self-image. I had a negative image about myself around, oh, I can't do this, or I'm no good. And at some point I began realizing that it was directly in proportion to another set of thoughts that said, I'm a really good yogi. I know just what I'm doing. Boy, I'm really good at this. And it was actually the clinging to that that was a setup for the other. That when I realized that it was the clinging to, oh, I can do this, I'm a good yogi, that when something happened and it's like, I wasn't, you know, it's like I couldn't see things, or it didn't fit, what was happening didn't fit with my idea of what a good yogi was, I suffered so much. It was so painful. And I finally realized, well, it's this idea I have of being a good yogi that is setting me up for this misery. And at that point, I realized that what I needed to be attuned to was the puffing up. And that was a little harder to see. I mean, boy, when I got into those miserable states, it was easy to recognize that I was suffering. It was not so easy to recognize that the puffing up part, I'm a good yogi. That felt pretty good when I told myself that. It's like, yeah, I know what I'm doing. That felt good. But that was the setup. And so when I realized that that was the setup for the misery, I started paying close attention to those thoughts and just recognized, oh, okay, there's another one of those. And I just like, yep, praising, praising myself. I started recognizing really how praise, that self-praise was a setup for myself. And that was a huge recognition for me, how those two pieces worked together and how I had to let go of that. You know, that kind of puffed upness, even though it felt good. I mean, it felt like, yeah, that feels good. It wasn't so helpful. I began to see very clearly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because letting go to me has always been, you know, taking a deep breath and relaxing. But you going through the idea of letting go.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
You talking about letting go, it's really quite the opposite. Because going through the whole process of letting go, you have to pave new paths and be cognizant. And so it's not like this, ultimately, you're trying for this peaceful state. But I haven't used the microphone. But I just found it, there's a dichotomy there. Because letting go, and we all have our own interpretation of what letting go is. You know, when you're meditating, but in this regard, you have to be very, very mindful. And I've actually known all this inside, and I often make conscious choices to, nope, don't go down that path.
Mm-hmm.
However, you know, in the day-to-day world, you do go down those paths, but the letting go of ultimately letting go is a lot of work.
It is a lot of work. It is a lot of work. You know, because it's like it's not, it's counter. The Buddha talked about it as going against the stream. It's counter to the kind of normal way that our whole culture sends us and our whole training sends us. So yeah, it is a lot of work. But on the other hand, you know, there's this beautiful analogy, that Joseph Goldstein uses, and he says, you know, at the beginning of practice, it's kind of like you're climbing this hill. You know, it's like you're climbing, trying to climb to the top of this hill, and it's a lot of work to make the effort to let go of the things that are so, they keep pulling at us. You know, all those habits and patterns are so strong. They've got so much momentum. We have to make a lot of effort to continue. Oh, yeah, I'll let go. Oh, yeah. Remember to note that thought about, I'm a good yogi. Remember to recognize those things. And at first, it's kind of like there's a lot of effort. But at some point, and this happens, you know, in over time in practice, and it can also happen on a long retreat, if you practice intensively for a while, at some point the mind gets into a place where it's kind of like that parabola where that hill flips. And where you want to go is just to let go and allow yourself to follow the flow of where the mind is more naturally, skillfully leading now. So that effort, it's like at some point that kind of movement to making effort flips, and it just becomes, oh, actually, the effort now is stressful. The effort needs to be let go, and the mind will more naturally move in a skillful direction.
It's like an athlete that trains.
It is, exactly. It's very similar. And, you know, Thanissaro Bhikkhu talks a lot about the skill of meditation and that the skill of meditation, the qualities for cultivating that skill, confidence that you can do it, energy applied to the task, mindfulness to move in that direction, concentration to focus the attention on the task, and wisdom, the things that you need to understand about that task. Those are the five faculties that the Buddha talks about as being the faculties that support us in meditation. And it's just like, it is cultivating a skill. And then as the skill gets honed, we don't have to try so hard anymore. And they're more naturally in play, those qualities. And we don't have to work like when you first start playing a piano, you've got to learn all the notes. You've got to figure out where the notes are. You really have to think about it. And over time, you can just look at the whole flow of the notes and just play it so that the skill allows us to move in that direction where we don't have to try so hard. And it is more of a letting go. It feels more like, oh, yeah, I don't have to work. I don't have to try so hard.
And I just want to say one more thing. I have acknowledged every week that I come in here to, you know, your talks, just how much work you put into it. And I really appreciate, you always have your, you know, notes there and you're giving quotes, and it's really, really nice. And I just wanted to let you know that I appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's a lot of work.
And now it's 9 o'clock, so we need to stop, unfortunately. I could, if you want to ask, you can come up.
It's just a little adder, you know, because we talk about letting go and I've done a lot of practice on that. It's, I think another word that I've come into, which I think we use in other ways, is acceptance.
Yes.
Because sometimes you catch yourself in letting go. You know, I always think that, you know, your mind is actually your worst enemy. You get trapped in your mind and you're sitting there kind of letting go. But maybe, you know, your mind's pretty smart. It might actually be suppressing it or hiding it or you know, avoiding it or, you know, tucking it somewhere underneath where you can't see it. Oh, I let it go. Not really. It's kind of hidden under there.
Yeah.
Look at it, you face it, I see you, I accept you, that's the way it is right now.
And you're absolutely right that the mind is so sneaky.
As soon as you accept it, it starts to dissolve whatever it is. And, I mean, that's so, to me, I think of the word acceptance.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't mean you don't do anything, it doesn't mean you just don't do anything about a situation you're in, but you accept it, okay, I accept it, okay, now I do X, Y, Z after that, you know, whatever it is. And, you know, it could be traffic.
Exactly.
Traffic is bad. I'm good. Always. I'm in traffic. Okay. Traffic. I accept you. Now I feel better. You know. So what am I going to do? Just going to keep driving and hopefully it opens up.
Yep. Yeah. Acceptance is another good way to look at the letting go. Yeah. Thank you. So we do need to stop. So thank you all.